This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We now know who the president's pick to fill the Supreme Court vacancy is. It's Brett Kavanaugh. And Professor Ronald Collins at the University of Washington Law School came pretty close to predicting it. This was one of your top picks, right?
Leading pick, yes. Sometimes the obvious is just that, right? Last night, the president said, I do not ask about a judge's personal opinions. Well, he didn't have to ask. The Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation had already done that for him. Brett Kavanaugh had long been at the top of the list. This was somebody that they had their eyes on, somebody that was bright, somebody that had a good personal and public image, and somebody who could bring about real change. So whether or not a Democrat or Republican tells you law is not political, don't believe them. It is more political, perhaps, than it's ever been, and that's true on both sides of the aisle. In fact, no sooner was this nomination announced that there were protests in front of the Supreme Court, including members of Congress who were out there. So what we've seen here is the politicization of the judicial nomination process. It's been moving that way for a long time, and there's no reason to believe that it'll change.
Well, he sounds like a nice guy. He's a family man. He coaches basketball. He said he will not... He will interpret the Constitution as written. And I expect Democrats to be against him because that's obviously the way things are. But, I mean, some people think this is the end of America as we know it. Is it?
Well, there are certain consequences that come with elections. So is he a decent man? Yes, as far as we can tell. Are his credentials impeccable? Yes, they are. But it's always the things we don't know. So when the Senate starts investigating into his time at the White House with President Bush, when they start digging deeper and deeper into all of these things and his involvement with the Ken Starr, Bill Clinton impeachment report, who knows what we'll find. But all things, as far as we can tell, though his nomination to the Court of Appeals was held up for 3 years, it's hard to see how the Democrats, based on what we know today, can defeat this nomination.
Well, one of the things that has come up is that he is on the record. This is an article he wrote in 2009, right, where he said a serious constitutional question exists regarding whether a president can be criminally indicted and tried while in office. And the thinking is this is the main reason that President Trump picked him, because this is his ace in the hole in case the Mueller investigation targets him.
I would push back a little bit on that. As I read the Minnesota Law Review article, he said that it appeared that a president could be tried criminally and civilly while in office. He thought it would be a disaster for the country, and he urged Congress to pass a law prohibiting that. In other words, any action to be taken against a president would have to be taken either civilly or criminally after he left the White House. So it's hard to say. But generally speaking, we do know this, based on his record of 300 opinions, that he is very much in favor of curbing congressional powers. He seems to be in favor of expanding executive powers. He seems also very concerned about dismantling the administrative state and really cutting back a lot, whether or not it be consumer protection or environmental protection, cutting back on the powers of administrative agencies. So I think all things being considered, he's probably likely to find an ally in the Chief Justice, John Roberts. They're not over-the-top Scalia conservatives who are kind of have that in-your-face constitutionalism. They tend to move much more on an incremental basis. So if they were to get abortion cases, I don't think, like Thomas and Gorsuch and perhaps Alito, that they would vote to overrule Roe on day one. I think they'd hold it out over time and do so incrementally. That's my guess. I could be wrong. But
Well, that's the big question, of course. Everyone wants to know, what would he do on abortion? And while nobody seems to think that Roe versus Wade is going to be overruled imminently, various states have been chipping away and testing the limits of the Supreme Court, and it sounds like they're pretty much getting a green light.
I would say a yellow light, let's put it that way, because these things take time. I mean, just because a state passes a wild-eyed law restricting reproductive rights doesn't mean that the circuit courts will uphold it and doesn't mean that the Supreme Court will necessarily hear the case. I mean, one of the consequences of losing an election is you lose these nominees to the court, and that's how our constitutional process works. Based on everything we know, it seems like he will be a respectable conservative justice with values very different from those espoused by the Warren Court.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, technology's catching up with the abortion issue. I was checking today, the pills are available online everywhere. I don't know how you'd enforce a prohibition these days anyway.
Well, you make an interesting point. I mean, just think about what the Internet did to the law of obscenity. The law of obscenity is still on the books, but as a functional matter, the advent of the Internet, you know, yeah, basically, pardon the expression, trumped it all.
So when you hear a guy say, I'm going to interpret the Constitution as written, what does that mean?
Don't believe it. I don't care if it's a Democrat or a liberal, a conservative or a libertarian. Now, the question is just how judicially active some of the conservative justices will be. I mean, right now, he's 53 years old, which means that he can sit on the court for over three decades and still be younger than Ruth Bader Ginsburg is now.
Professor Ronald Collins teaches at the University of Washington Law School as the Harold S. Scheffelman Scholar. And, Professor, we appreciate your time again.
As always, thank you for having me.
Internationally, among all of President Trump's punching bags, it's our allies that seem to get hammered the hardest. NATO has long been the president's favorite target. Last year, Mr. Trump stood in front of NATO leaders and gave them a lecture, reminding them to pay up.
NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations. But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense.
And he's still at it, hammering away all week on Twitter about the raw deal the U.S. is getting. And so he's off to Brussels tomorrow to meet with our traditional allies in Europe and then to meet with Vladimir Putin. Let's go to CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, we've heard the president say this, of course, ever since the campaign. Does he have a point?
Well, to a significant extent, the president does have a point when he talks about the mutual defense obligations that these NATO countries committed to back in 2014 over the course of Barack Obama's administration. The point he doesn't make, that they gladly would, is that it was a 10-year promise in 2014 that by the year 2024, they would each commit to spending 2% of their gross national product on defense. The head of NATO, the Secretary General, said here today to try to ease the tension that all of the NATO countries this year are spending more on defense than they did last year. He calls that a good start, but he also says the president is right, that the NATO partners have to do more. What's interesting is beyond that mutual defense budget issue, you've got the tough talk from the president about the, you know, overall futility of the transatlantic alliance and the trade dynamic. And the president doesn't seem to be separating the two. In fact, he says that America is losing money to the NATO partners, and they're also treating America unfairly when it comes to how much they spend on defense. These NATO allies have long memories, and they you know, wonder whether the United States is backing away from its commitment over the course of the 20th century and beyond into the 21st to stand up for Europe against mainly Russian aggression.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's been now a considerable number of years since World War II. NATO does have there is a European Union. Why should they not defend themselves at this point, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, that's the argument the president makes. And ultimately, the EU chief says it's about more than money. And he says, you know, as you meet with Putin next week, remember that NATO stood by you after 9/11. That is, stood by the United States after 9/11. And that's the argument that the Europeans will make, that the solidarity that they have expressed and are willing to express is about more than just dollars and cents. From the president's perspective, you know, the U.S. has been taken advantage of by the entire world, and he's going to be the answer to that. What he's going to face here is an icy reception. He actually said this morning as he left Washington that between the tough talk he'll have here at NATO, the very strange dynamic right now in the UK where Theresa May's government is on the brink of collapse over Brexit.
Right.
And these are developments that have just happened in the last couple of days if you haven't been paying close attention.
Yeah, her critics are saying she's been a little too mild about it.
Well, right. Well, the easiest meeting he says he'll have while he's here in Europe will be with Vladimir Putin on Monday. He goes, what do you make of that? Well, the Europeans don't like hearing things like that. They're very concerned that the United States will not live up to its commitment under the North Atlantic Treaty to defend these NATO partners if Russia were to do what it did to Ukraine, and that is annex some of its land.
Yeah. In this meeting with Vladimir Putin, he has asked once again, insisted, on a one-on-one session, correct? Just Trump, Putin, and their translators. There was, and I'll have to get a brief answer, even though I know it's a long one. There was a New York Magazine article saying that in that meeting, he's going to try and cut a deal for some kind of real estate deal. Have you heard about this?
No, I have not heard that specific report, but the president, two points I'll make. One is, it's not the first time the president will have met personally with Putin. He did it last year on the sidelines of the G20 summit. They also met on the sidelines of the APEC summit. As far as it goes with a deal with Russia, I don't know about one for him personally, any kind of real estate, but the president's been talking about a deal with Russia, undefined, from the very beginning. In fact, since the campaign, there has been no deal that has materialized. And you have to wonder, a lot of experts in foreign policy do, just what the president actually hopes to accomplish here in Europe this week.
All right, Stephen Portnoy, CBS correspondent. Thank you, Stephen. We'll hear more about that when we talk with a professor from... Which school is he from? I talked to so many professors. Anyway, Harvard. Okay, the Harvard guy who says there's a reason for these one-on-ones that the president has with Putin and Kim Jong-un, which bowled me over, but that'll be probably tomorrow. Since last year, Snohomish County has been taking a coordinated approach to tackling the opioid epidemic with county agencies on the front lines working together to try and do something about it. And as part of that, the county has launched its second annual opioid point in time count this week. And Hannah Scott is here to tell us about that, Hannah.
And Dave, unlike the annual homeless point in time counts that we see in various counties in our state that focus on a one-night count of homeless people, the Snohomish County Health District's opioid point in time count happens over a seven-day period to create a snapshot of overdoses in the county. Local fire, police, paramedics, clinics, hospitals, and other county agencies all team up to track the number of both fatal and non-fatal overdoses in that period, along with where they happened, the drugs involved, and details about the people who actually overdosed. Sherry Ireton with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office says the goal here is...
It helps all of us, the government agencies and service providers, have a better idea of just how widespread the impact of the opioid epidemic is, as well as other drugs like meth.
The county conducted the count for the first time in 2017. Now, over that seven-day period, there were 37 opioid-related overdoses reported, including 10 in just one day. Three of those were fatal. But the breakdown of those opioid overdose numbers was what was really eye-opening.
Just how it's really hitting all facets of our community. So we had, you know, kids on that list. We had elderly people into their 70s and 80s. It's not just overdoses that are showing up at the emergency room. It's those being responded to out in the field by patrol or EMS. And it was all over the county. It's not just in one spot.
So you were out with her doing this count?
The count started yesterday, and I went along with one of the teams, the outreach teams who were doing the count yesterday. There's various agencies, and I'll be out with many of them throughout the week. But yesterday, the count launched.
They go out and just look for people who are addicted?
So these are, again, people who are on the front lines all the time, right?
Oh,
so the team I went out with yesterday was the embedded social worker outreach teams who go out to the encampments and try to lure people into treatment, into detox centers, but they often also come across people who have overdosed. That did not happen yesterday, but they will be part of the county workers who will, for 7 days, be tallying any overdoses they come across. So again, we'll have fire, police, hospitals, the syringe exchange, in various places like that, who will tally these things up for 7 days. Yesterday, as we were just talking about, I got to go out with one of the outreach teams who were doing an outreach effort in a homeless encampment in South Everett. Now, the goal that they have is to get them people that they meet out there who have been chronically homeless over the last few years, who are dealing with addiction, mental health issues off the streets, and convince them to get into treatment facilities. Now, the new tool they have this year, and this is partly because of that count that was done last year, which allowed the county to lobby the state for some money for this new diversion center. Now, that's a 44-bed facility at the county campus that serves as a detox center. So if they go out and they find these folks who are ready to get some help, that don't have a treatment bed at a facility yet that they can go to, they can go to this diversion center for 15 days. They can get treated with Suboxone and detox, which you have to do before you can be allowed into a treatment facility. So that's what we were doing yesterday. Deputy Bud McCurry is with the team that I went out with yesterday, and he says the key is to continually reach out to these people, get to know them, and then being there when they hit rock bottom.
My approach to our clients out here is this scale of 1 to 10. On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad do you want to be clean and sober? And a lot of them are honest. They're like, 6 or 7. I always ask them, what makes up those last 3 or 4 points? What has to happen to you to finally say, I need out of these woods? That's more realistic. You get honest answers from people. It's the people that reach that 7, 8, 9, or 10 that finally take us up on our offer to go to the diversion center.
So it's a lot of repetitive work. Yesterday, as we went out to this encampment in South Everett, we snaked our way through the deep wooded area, and we came across mounds of garbage, scattered needles, human waste everywhere, and everything from women's lingerie hanging in a tree to a unicycle and in between. Of course, multiple tents, and at each tent we came across...
Police, Sheriff's Office. Anybody in there? Police, Sheriff's Office, anybody in there?
Deputy McCurry uses his baton to knock and announce his presence. Now, nobody was home at most of the tents that we went to, so in those cases, the team leaves a pamphlet with their phone number and all of the details about how they can help get people into that diversion center for detox, then into treatment facilities, and eventually sober housing if they succeed, and help finding a job and more. But as we continued to wind our way back deep into the woods, we came across 2 tents, and this time...
You guys know you're trespassing, right?
The people staying in them were there. In the first tent, it was a man and a woman.
The female that we contacted, we've talked to her for a couple of years now. Allegedly, she's on a methadone program. Can't verify if she is currently being treated or not. The male that was in there, obviously standoffish with law enforcement, did give his name and information, but did not want to answer any other questions. He actually didn't even want to take my card for future help. Severe distrust of police right there. Basically, we left it with them as gather your stuff and go. They had to go.
And the social worker with the deputy talked to that couple about options. She did eventually give them her card, but in the end, the couple packed up their stuff and headed out, likely moving to another camp, according to the deputy. Now, in the tent behind them, though, there was a different story when McCurry and his team ran into Mike, a man dealing with addiction and mental health issues that they've been talking to for a couple of years now.
Mike.
Hey.
Been a long time.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah.
You're not looking so hot. No offense.
Yeah, I just woke up to you.
What are we going to do to get you out of here?
Are you done? Are you done with this?
Yeah.
Lifestyle?
Oh, yeah. I'm ready to move on.
How ready? Scale 1 to 10?
So this time around, Mike said he was much closer to being ready.
Is that what he was saying?
He was.
I couldn't quite understand that.
Yeah, it was hard to understand him. He's clearly been out on the streets for a long time. In the end, though, he talked with the social worker, and they have an appointment to meet with him, I believe, tomorrow, where they're going to pick him up out front of that encampment. They'll take him to lunch. They'll try to convince him to go into that diversion center for detox and then move on to a treatment facility. So that's just one of the several aspects that will be going on throughout this week, one of the several groups that will be tallying up, as I said, any overdoses that they come across. Now, at that diversion center, though, that's what that number helped to get some money from the state last year, and that's been a big deal. That's the first of its kind in the state. I believe they're looking at doing another one in Spokane. So far, that 44-bed facility has 8 people in it right now, but several have already passed through and into treatment. They have 17 people in treatment as we speak right now.
So your experience going from tent to tent like that, did that make you feel more secure about having people like that in the neighborhood or less secure about having people like that?
No, less secure. Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll tell you, where we were was off of 128th out there in Everett and Admiralty Way. And it's just it's private property. It's not owned by the county, and it's just not really maintained. So, and if you had kids walking by there, and they wanted to go and explore in the woods, oh my goodness, you'd have to be concerned. Yeah. There's broken glass. There's needles uncapped with exposed, points on the end. There were just the amount of human waste along the trail was absolutely incredible. That's one thing they said they were more worried about that than the actual needles that we came across is something that they have to deal with all the time. Nothing, you know, the one gentleman who was with the woman in the tent was really standoffish. The deputy said he maybe had some gang killers going on. He was concerned and kind of hung back and watched because they were still in there as we were.
How are they making a living? How are they getting food?
I, you know, who knows? It could be anything from, you know, places that provide food to people who are living on the streets to maybe there's, you know, snatching stuff from the store. I don't know. We saw a lot of cans of like Bush's baked beans and boxes of cereal laying around, things of that nature. Clothes, everything. Like I said, there were bras and panties hanging in a tree, drying out as if they had been laundered, things like that. But just there were some tents there that were literally just piles of garbage inside. There were no people. There was no way anyone was staying in there. But there's nobody in there cleaning it up. So that's another thing they're looking at, too, is when it's a private property like that, it's the property owner's responsibility to do something about that, to have people go in there and clean it out.
Some people will say, I'm at a six. I'm not going to leave just yet.
No, and that happens. And again, this is about repetition. So these embedded social worker teams have been in place since 2015. There are now six, I believe, in the county. Everett has one, Marysville, Monroe, Arlington, and Linwood.
And to be clear, these people you're traveling with were giving these campers the prospect of immediate help.
We'll
take you out
right
of there now.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And this they do so much. So they go and they'll get you in that diversion center where you can stay for up to 15 days. You get treated with Suboxone if you need it or whatever else you might need for treatment. And then they'll find you a treatment facility, which is never inside of Snohomish County because there aren't any except for pregnant women there, they said. They end up driving them to wherever they need to go, sometimes out of state, sometimes, you know, Whatcom County, wherever they can get a bed. Then from there, after they do their treatment, these teams go up. They pick them up the day they're out and they get them in sober housing that the county works with. And then from there, eventually down the line, as part of this diversion center program, there'll be a facility across that campus on the county where they can get hooked up with all the services they need, help finding a job, help getting their driver's license, every kind of service all in one place. Because that's one of the big challenges here is navigating this system for these people who have been out of it for so long. They need that help. They need that guidance.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
He's aboard the plane, and tomorrow the president will meet with NATO leaders, who he continues to anger with his demands for cash. And he's also put them on edge with his unusual pursuit of some kind of deal with Vladimir Putin. On Monday, he will meet with Vladimir Putin, and there is a pretty explosive story in New York Magazine that purports to explain, and I want to emphasize that this is an attempt to string together, you know, a group of facts. This is not the Mueller investigation or anything, but it attempts to explain why Donald Trump is so eager to cut this deal. The story claims that he is, in fact, a Russian asset and that they laid the groundwork for this back in 1987. Now, since I can think of no one who has tried to understand Donald Trump's finances more closely than David Farenthold, I want to bounce this off him. So you read this article, David, right?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
Well, as you said, it's an attempt to sort of string together a bunch of facts plus a few things that we suspect or we've heard rumored but we don't know and try to – the author says he's trying to put the sort of worst possible explanation for this. You know, what's the most panic-worthy explanation? And that is he's come up with this idea that the president is friendly toward Vladimir Putin's aims and toward Putin personally because he is effectively controlled by the Russians and he has been – the KGB began cultivating him in the 80s and that's carried over to now.
Well, do you – I mean, when I ask you what you think, as a journalist, as a Pulitzer Prize winner, is this credible journalism or is this just going to feed into what Donald Trump has said, fake news?
But it's not really journalism. I mean, the writer takes a bunch of things that are known and sort of puts them together, and it's obviously well known and journalistically documented that Trump is very friendly toward Putin's aims and is serving Putin's aims, you know, by trying to break up NAFTA, by trying to undermine the EU, by undermining NATO. He sort of seeks an explanation for that. So it's true that Trump is doing what Putin wants effectively across Europe, much more than I think Putin would have ever hoped for. But the part that sort of crosses into conjecture is why. I think we know a lot about Trump's connections to attempted business connections with Russia. Maybe there's more we'd like to know, but we haven't seen anything close to proof that he is a controlled KGB asset or anything like that.
Okay. I wouldn't even have read the story, except I've been interviewing a professor of Russian studies who told me something that I found even more shocking. And we haven't even played the interview yet. We're sort of hanging on to it. But he said that there is a reason that Donald Trump wants to be in these one-on-one meetings with only translators there. And that is because he is actually cutting personal deals. Now, this floor, I know there are people who don't like Trump, but I've not heard allegations like that from credible sources before. Now, you follow his financing. What do you think about that?
Well, we really haven't seen any proof for that. There's been a lot of stories about attempts by Trump to build in Russia, you know, to start a Trump Tower in Moscow or to license his name to places in Russia or the former Soviet Union. And almost all those came to naught. There was one tower in Azerbaijan that got built and then abandoned. And there's been some conjecture about we wrote a story earlier this year about how Trump sort of went on this unusual cash buying spree at a time when, you know, he switched from buying things on credit, taking out loans like a normal real estate developer, and buying things in all cash. And there's been some speculation by others that maybe that cash was Russian or the Russians had something to do with it, drawing basically on one piece of evidence, which is that a golf writer says that Eric Trump once told him that their money was all Russian. And they did have Russian investors in an above-board way in a lot of other condo buildings they had. That all adds up to sort of questions, and we want to know more about whether Russia played any role in financing Trump's purchases of golf courses and other things. But as you said, I've looked at it a lot. I haven't found anything that says there's an ironclad proof that Trump actually, you know, got some kind of financing from Russia.
All right, good. Well, then I'll take it with a grain of salt. To be continued.
Definitely.
In the meantime, what's the talk about around the news? We haven't talked since the latest cabinet shift, Scott Pruitt leaving. What's the status of the White House organization? This is a time when presidents should be hitting their stride. You know, he's learned the ropes. They can do the job. What's his status now?
Well, I mean, he's had more turnover in his cabinet so far than I think just about anybody in modern American history. So Pruitt leaving, that would be the most recent example. In some cases, like the EPA, Pruitt was replaced by somebody who was less sort of flagrantly corrupt, draws less attention, but will still carry out basically Trump's environmental agenda, which is to empower coal companies to try to roll back environmental regulations. So in that way, I think Trump has found somebody who will carry out his agenda far more effectively because he won't have that kind of personal baggage. So Trump's cabinet has had a lot of turnover. I think Trump is not a great micromanager. I think what we've seen is that he gives his cabinet secretaries a huge amount of leeway to pursue whatever agenda they want. And so I think that, changing personnel actually matters a lot because then you get the agenda of the person that you're hiring, and Trump doesn't seem to check in very often.
Okay. On the Supreme Court fight that's coming up, the Democrats have promised total war. But as far as I can tell, I guess I don't see the point unless this is just strictly to energize their political base, because the guy seems like a moderate, or am I reading that wrong?
Well, I mean, he's a conservative, but he is the kind of conservative that, you know, Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or anybody else, you know, in the Republican primary field would have nominated. With Trump, Trump benefits from a low bar. But in this case, he didn't nominate Judge Jeanine off Fox News. He did not, he didn't nominate his sister
right.
as a federal judge.
Right.
He nominated a guy that any other Republican would have nominated. So, there's a lot of talk now about maybe the Democrats will be able to block it, or maybe, they need Republican help. Maybe they'd get help from Senator Rand Paul or Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins. No one's going to block this. This is going to happen. And I think in the end, it will pass like Justice Neil Gorsuch did, with two or three Democratic votes in addition to all the Republican votes. For the Democrats, I think you said it right. There's no real incentive for them to actually block this guy, because then Trump would just nominate somebody else who would have the same kind of conservative bent. They're not going to, block him enough that he nominates Merrick Garland, Obama's.
Well, his boss, this guy's boss was Merrick Garland, right?
Right. I mean, so this guy, he has a very conventional resume. He worked for Anthony Kennedy, the justice that just retired. I mean, the Democrats are going to fight this to a degree to fire up their base and to try to tell them, look, you know, let's get ready for what's coming next. You know, Roe versus Wade could be under threat. You know, it's important to elect Democrats now so we can stop that. I think the Democrats see this primarily as a way of angering and sort of firing up their base. But do any of them have a realistic hope that they're going to be able to block this pick?
Yeah.
No. And if, like I said, if they did, what would they get? Somebody just like him.
Yeah. Here's another story that I saw I want to check out with you. There was one piece that drew a line from this nomination to a government shutdown in October. What have you heard about that?
Trump has threatened government shutdowns. Shut the government down if he doesn't get money for his wall. Republicans have said they'll shut the government down, or Democrats. I don't think anybody's going to shut the government down a month before the midterm elections. Nobody wants to be seen or take the risk of being seen as, sort of flamethrowing, you know, blow up the government types, unproductive types, especially Democrats. I don't see that happening. I don't think anybody has the incentive right before midterm election.
All right. David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You may have heard that there has been an outbreak of measles in the area. And to tell us what we have to watch out for, Dr. Gordon Cohen joins us. Just to be clear, this is not the German measles I had as a kid, right?
No, good morning, Dave. This is not German measles. This is an entirely different virus.
And measles supposedly was eradicated, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It was thought that in 2000 that we had eradicated measles from the United States, and we went for nearly 10 years without any reported cases of measles. And then in 2010, there were 63 cases of measles reported in the United States. So it reappeared in the country. Measles was largely eradicated through the process of vaccination.
So is this the result of people deciding that vaccines are no longer a safe thing to do?
That's a great question. And it's actually a combination of things. So measles, number one, is a highly, highly contagious disease. Unlike a lot of diseases, you can get measles from just being in the same room as another person. Now, secondly, measles still exists worldwide, and it's actually a very common virus and disease around the world, primarily in developing areas of Africa and Asia. And in fact, there's about 20 million people a year who get the measles. But in this country, we're able to get rid of it through vaccinations. Now, the thing is that people have made decisions over the past couple of decades that it's not safe to vaccinate your kid. And it's interesting that it was the measles vaccine that was the vaccine that was thought to cause autism. Mm-hmm. And there was actually...
Well, now, when you say that, was there ever any survey that actually showed it did, that ever did associate it with autism?
No, there wasn't. And
this was made up, as far as I know.
It was made up. In fact, there was a paper that was published in the Lancet, again, a very reputable journal, in 1998 by a doctor named Andrew Wakefield in the United Kingdom. And he presented what actually turned out to be falsified evidence that the MMR vaccine, which is mumps, measles, and rubella, that vaccine caused children to develop autism or autism spectrum disorders. Yeah. But it was later disproven, and the paper was retracted in 2010, and he was stripped of all of his credentials.
Yeah, okay. So how dangerous is measles?
So measles is highly contagious, and it's an upper respiratory infection. So it typically presents with a high fever. Usually it's higher than 104 degrees Fahrenheit. And then you get a cough and a runny nose and inflamed eyes like you would with any other type of respiratory illness. But what's characteristic of it are a couple other things. One is that you get a red flat rash, which usually starts on the face, and then it spreads to the rest of the body. And then you get these white spots inside of your mouth, and they're called Koplik spots. Now, the thing is most people will recover from measles. But about 30% of cases include more serious symptoms, which include diarrhea or really significant things like blindness, inflammation of the brain, or pneumonia. And so it's these things that are really problematic and can result in death.
So if you had your immunization as a kid, is it still good now?
Yeah, it should be good now. Most vaccinations that occur in childhood usually provide lifelong immunity.
Well, okay, that's comforting anyway. So what is the current trend among new mothers in terms of vaccinations. Is there still this fear, which we now know is unfounded, and are we really risking losing that herd immunity that had made measles rare before?
So there was a bigger concern and a bigger scare, you know, about a decade ago with people getting immunizations. It seems to have gotten less. People are tending to get immunized more and more. But still, it remains a public health issue based on this falsified paper from 1998 where people really were scared about the risk of their children developing autism as a result of receiving vaccinations, primarily this vaccination. But the fact of the matter is that the vaccinations work. They're safe. There's no real risk associated with them. You can't get the disease from the vaccine, and it prevents you from getting the disease, and it prevents others around you from getting sick as a result of you being exposed.
So how would you know if you've contracted it?
So, Dave, it typically takes about 10 to 14 days from the time that the virus enters the body, from the time you're actually exposed to it, to the beginning of the symptoms. So the classic symptoms include a four-day fever, usually, like I said, 104 degrees roughly. Then you can get a cough. You can get head cold-like symptoms, fever and sneezing, and then conjunctivitis. And as I mentioned earlier, you will then get this red rash that usually starts on your face and moves down your body, and you'll get these white spots in your mouth. So if you haven't been vaccinated for measles and you start to develop any of these symptoms, it's really important to hydrate yourself, contact your physician right away. Don't go visit the physician's office. Rather, call their office and see how they want to handle it.
All right. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Definitely frightening. And the Snohomish County Health District actually has some information, as does the state, on the measles. And they typically keep track of reports of the measles. So when they do have a case where somebody has been in public spaces who has confirmed measles and they get the word out, they have the list of all the restaurants, all of the locations. There was a Walmart that this child was at in Snohomish County. They have a list of those locations at their website and then what you can do about it if you need to know. So just check out the Snohomish County Health or the Washington State Department of Health websites if you want help with that.
And time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Mariners were off, so we get to just discuss hot stove stuff. We have a hot stove day.
That's interesting to have hot stove, because generally that's in the winter to keep the house warm.
Yeah, I know.
So what are we doing here? This could be like the fire pit day. Let's get we've got our summer fire pit going.
We have a day to take stock, I guess, as we're heading into the All-Star break. How much are we missing Robinson Cano?
They're missing him, and that's something that's been it's been covered up by how well the starting pitching is at. They've won as frequently without Robinson Cano as they did with him, which is a huge testament to the team. But that shouldn't convince anyone that they're not missing him. Because the reason they're winning has nothing to do with Robinson Cano's presence or his absence. It's the pitching. They're averaging 0.6 runs per game less since he was suspended. That's a significant number. Went from 4.6 to just over 4. That fact alone is enough to make you realize that they do miss him. And when they score one run on Friday against Colorado and one run on Saturday against Colorado, and then they salvage the series by winning one game on Sunday because Ryan Healy drove in 5 of their 6 runs, you do start to realize, like, hey, that looks like a team that's missing its best hitter. He's still got 29 games more before he's eligible to return. And then remember, he's not going to be able to play in the postseason, but they miss him.
But that tells me, as an amateur sports observer, that what they've got is this turbocharged switch, you know, that they're like 29 days games away from flipping, and then bazoom, you know, they just dominate the division.
That is going to be something. They have an asset coming in Robinson Cano. They're going to have him for the final 40 some games. That is a huge, that will help. But you've also got a plan for, and this is where the weirdness of it is that if you do make the playoffs, which is looking increasingly likely, you're not going to have him. So they've got some decisions. He's ineligible for the postseason because of the drug suspension. Yeah.
Wait a second. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he'll come back for the 40-some games after missing the 80, and then he will be ineligible for the postseason. A few years ago, a guy named Melky Cabrera, who was actually a pretty good friend of Robinson Cano's, he was suspended during the year, And then he came back and had served his suspension and was eligible for the playoffs and was great in the playoffs. And nobody liked that. Didn't sit well with baseball. The idea that this guy was suspended for PEDs.
That's crazy. I don't get it. So the punishment is not really enough of a punishment unless they destroy your playoff chances as well. Is that what it is?
Yes. That they don't want someone missing half the year for a drug suspension and then coming back and making the difference in the playoffs.
Okay. Why is Russell Wilson going to China to promote Alibaba?
Well, that was very interesting because he appeared at Alibaba headquarters. And for those that don't know, Alibaba is, would you call it the Chinese rival to Amazon?
Amazon, yeah.
So it would be there. On the one hand, you wonder what he's doing endorsing something other than the home company. On the other hand, Russell hasn't had the best taste or luck when it comes to his business ventures. Do you remember Eat the Ball?
Oh, yeah, the bread, the football-shaped bread.
That's right. It was white bread shaped like a football. Or the Good Man brand. That was a high-end style of lifestyle clothing for guys. Nano bubbles, I think it was called Recovery Water.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah, that was the nano bubbles that he thought prevented him from suffering a concussion. Yeah, so there's all sorts of stuff that'll be there. But yeah, he was at Alibaba headquarters and he said, we've got big things coming up. My father-in-law, who just left yesterday, had spent the past week up here. My in-laws were in town and he was very interested in that. He emigrated here from China, from Hong Kong. He was born in China, went to Hong Kong, and came over here. And he was wondering what that meant. He was very surprised to see him in potentially endorsing Alibaba.
So Russell's really serious about planning his post-football career.
Huh? He wants to do a lot of business ventures. I admire the effort. If I was him, I'd be on a beach somewhere collecting 20% like Hans Gruber.
He wants to get independently wealthy so he can run for office.
Do you think that's true?
Yep.
Do you think politics is in his future?
I do.
It'll be interesting. What kind of candidate would he be?
I don't know, but he's inscrutable to begin with unless he changes the way he handles news conferences. But he's got... you're going to need to be a superstar in the future to be an effective politician, and he might have that in him.
Because there are examples. Steve Largent was a congressman for Oklahoma, and you've had other guys I know that have gone on to it. Bill Bradley's probably the most famous athlete who then had a career in politics after that. Right.
Bill Bradley became there. I mean, nobody would have thought it, but he became a very respected elder statesman.
I wonder what Russell would he have to say more than he does.
Yes. At some point.
He would have to actually...
But he also knows how to do the patter where you say a lot, but nothing.
Yeah. Is that an asset in politics?
Yes. Yes, it is. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.